Welcome back to the program. Earlier in the week, it was my privilege to chat with Nehemiah Gordon from Jerusalem, the author of The Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus and co-author of A Prayer to Our Father. The website is www.aprayertoourfather.com. And we spoke about a number of topics, including the Torah of Nida from Leviticus chapter 15. Listen up. I was speaking to, as you know, I was speaking to Keith a little earlier on, in fact, last week's program, and I asked him about the recent tour that you guys did, traveling around promoting the book A Prayer to Our Father, and he told me one of the more challenging things that you guys had to do was a presentation of the book in the space of 2 minutes, in fact, 60 seconds each. I'm going to ask you the same question that I asked him. How were you able... In all seriousness, how were you able to summarize the book in 60 seconds?
Well, it was tough. And let me give you a little bit more, and he may have discussed this, but the background was that there's this thing called the Jewish Book Council, which is 100 representatives of various Jewish organizations around the United States primarily, and they come together to screen authors for their Jewish Book Month and the Jewish book fairs they have around the United States. And there were 250 authors. So the way that they do it is it's basically like speed dating for authors. You know, in speed dating, you have like just a few minutes to talk to a woman, then you go to the next woman. Well, here it was with authors. We got up, and each author had 2 minutes. Well, me going up there with Keith, I had to split my time with him, so 60 seconds each. And so I just started off saying the obvious. I said, you know, especially since this was the Jewish Book Council, and here we are coming to talk about We're a white Israeli Bible scholar with an African-American Methodist pastor coming to talk about the Hebrew origins of the Lord's Prayer. So I just started off saying, what on earth are these guys doing here, you're probably thinking. And I kind of just stated the obvious, and I explained to them that what we're doing here is talking about this prayer that Jesus taught, that Jesus was a Jew, and he was speaking and teaching a Jewish audience. And billions of Christians look to this prayer and use this prayer that was written by a Jew. And very often there are misunderstandings about it because they don't understand the Jewish background of that prayer. And what Keith and I have done is we've gotten together, and through this amazing interfaith dialogue, we've uncovered a lot of the lost Hebrew meaning behind this prayer that's loved by 2 billion Christians. And so not only are we doing what others have done in the past, because there was this... professor at the Jewish Theological Seminary in the United States. It's the main seminary of the conservative Jewish movement. And every year he used to open up his class and he would recite the Lord's Prayer in Hebrew and then ask the students, where is this from? And they wanted to impress the professor, so they'd say, oh, that must be from the Musaf prayers after, you know, on Rosh Hashanah, after such and such. And very, you know, in most years, nobody would get it. And then at the end, he'd tell them, this is, I just read to you the Lord's Prayer. And they were shocked because content-wise, it sounds like you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of other Jewish prayers. Sure. There's nothing in the content that would betray, that would give away that this was a prayer written by ostensibly what most people consider to be the founder of Christianity. Mm. So that's basically how we presented it to them. Obviously, I just took more than a minute, so I gave the condensed version. And it was a challenge because those who have heard me speak know that I usually take about 45 minutes just to say my name, and you know, it's funny because traveling around with Keith, one of the things he's taught me is that many Christian audiences, you can't talk to them for more than 20 minutes or they fall asleep, because you know they're used to 20-minute sermon every Sunday morning, and you come there and you talk for more than that, they don't know what to do. Well, I was speaking at this congregation, a Hebrew Roots congregation over in Amarillo, Texas, and the man asked me, how long will you need? And I said, well, I'd like to go for 2 or 3 hours if that's okay. You know, and I'm thinking like he's going to say, well, you know, we don't have that much time, 45 minutes. But what he says to me is, we've never had a speaker who only spoke for 2 to 3 hours. I said, well, wait, you want me to, you're going to give me more time than that? I ended up speaking for 5 hours.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah. And the people wanted, you know, the people were, they soaked it up. I mean, you know, everyone was sitting there and the whole 5 hours. We took some breaks in the middle, of course. But, you know, so I guess there's different kind of audiences. And anyway, there it was, the two minutes, and that was a challenge. And it wasn't just a challenge because it was, you know, 60 seconds each. It was a challenge because of the presenting that particular subject matter to that particular audience, it would have been a challenge in 45 minutes or 2 hours. And what's amazing is that it was received with open arms. I mean, we received a number of invitations, and we ended up going and speaking actually at a synagogue and some Jewish community centers. And it was really, really a blessing that I was able to stand in a Jewish synagogue and talk about the Hebrew origins of the Lord's Prayer. One of the things I shared about in the synagogue was about the phrase, "May your name be sanctified." That's a phrase that both Keith and I are very passionate about. In the English, it's normally "Hallowed be thy name." And "May your name be sanctified," I'm sure Keith explained, is a call to action to sanctify the name. Now, what name? It starts off "Our Father in heaven." So the name of our Father, which is in Hebrew, in the early manuscripts, it's written Yehovah. And so as I was explaining this in the synagogue, the cantor who was running the event, I asked him, is it okay if I say the name? And he said, yes, we'd love to hear it. And that was probably the most moving moment for me of, you know, I've spoken at, can't even count how many dozens of places, maybe hundreds of places. And that was the most moving moment for me in that entire time, because there I was able to stand in a legitimate Jewish synagogue and speak the name of God, and it was received very well. The people wanted to hear it, and you have to understand, from my background being raised Orthodox, that's not something I'm used to. In the Orthodox world, I assume, and I could be wrong, but certainly from my own experience, I don't think it would be welcome for me to, they might want to hear about the general topic, but I don't think it would be welcome to actually say the name Yehovah in that synagogue, in an Orthodox synagogue.
My understanding is that, of course, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but they replace it, generally speaking, with Hashem or with Adonai.
Right, absolutely. And one of the things that we did that was really, I think, great is I've been working with this singer in South Africa, Andrew Hodgkinson. I believe he's been on your show.
We're desperately waiting for his new album to come out. I understand that it is due possibly in January. And we played his latest single. In fact, we play it every week, which is Blessed is the Man.
Oh, wow.
And, of course, we opened the program with the Yavin New Prayer.
Wow. Okay. So yeah, I've actually heard some previews of some of the things that are going to be got a sneak preview, and it's an amazing album. I mean, Blessed is the Man is the tip of the iceberg. It's going to be a powerful album. But part of the thing of what we did with Blessed is the Man is we decided to have a music video made that we broadcast on God's Learning Channel. And this friend of mine who was actually living in Israel a few years back, he is a man named Newman. He's Jewish, actually a Kohen, meaning a descendant of Aaron.
Sure.
And he's a film student, so we asked him to make a music video. And there's a great story behind, you know, why we chose him. But anyway, in this music video, he hires an actor, and I think he paid the actor $23, but I don't remember the exact details. But it was a guy he brought on as an actor. We didn't even know the actor's name. It was, you know, a short music video. There weren't even actor credits. And this actor took the music video. He actually downloaded it from YouTube where we had posted it, and posted it on his own YouTube page. And on his YouTube page, and here's part of the backstory, is this actor is an Orthodox Jew.
Oh,
we had no idea. I mean, it's somebody that was paid $23. We don't know who he is. I mean, he's some anonymous guy to us. But he saw the video, and he was so proud of it, and he so much embraced the message that he posted on his own YouTube page, except he went through and he dubbed it, and we had no idea he was going to do this, and he put a shofar blast over the two places in the song where Andrew sings the name Yehovah.
Oh, wow.
Now, at first I was really upset and Andrew was upset, but Keith had the wisdom. He said, wait a minute, if the only thing that he couldn't live with in the video was the name, then that's a testimony about everything that we're doing. That actually reinforces that what we're doing, that people need to hear this name. And it also reinforces the message, because the message of the video, it was based on Psalm 1, "Blessed is the man," is talking about people who keep the Torah, that's a blessing. And one of the things that we wanted to convey in the video, and Newman did so powerfully, you know, through the visual, is that blessed is the man. It doesn't say blessed is the Jew or blessed is the Israelite. Mm. It's blessed is the man, that this is a message for all mankind. And that was something that Newman was effectively able to convey through images. And the fact that this Orthodox man embraced the entire message of the video, except that one thing he just wasn't comfortable with, because tradition says we can't hear this name, so he gets to cover it with the shofar blast. And I think the fact that he chose a shofar blast, I don't know if he realizes how, in a way, prophetic that is. Because if you look at the story at Mount Sinai, where they come and they and all 600,000 Israelite males and the women and the children, probably 2 to 3 million people, that come and they hear God himself speak to the people, not through a prophet like later on happened, but God himself speaks to 2 to 3 million people. And what happens? How does it begin? If you look at the story in Exodus, it begins with the shofar blast. And then they hear him say, Anochi Yehovah Elohecha, I am Yehovah your God. So I don't know if this Orthodox man even made that association, that as you're hearing the sound of the shofar blast, you hear the name Yehovah for the first time from his mouth directly, wow. The entire nation. I mean, I think there's something prophetic there that just blows my mind. So at first I was upset, like, why did he mess with our video? He didn't have a right. He was just an actor. But I think that, in a way, he made our point better than we made it. So perhaps, it's pretty exciting.
It's a good point that you make. Another thing that comes to my mind, and I just want to remind listeners, if you go to YouTube, if you put in Andrew Hodkinson, Blessed is the Man, it is a video well worth watching. I was blessed by watching it. I watched it a number of times, and it's a beautiful video. It's a beautiful song. And another thing that comes to mind in regards to what you're talking about was, of course, there is blue in the tzitzit, isn't there? And according to
absolutely.
Rabbinic tradition, their tzitzit are only whites, and I suppose he left that in the clip.
Well, actually, that's something that's changed in the last 20 to 30 years.
Really?
20 to 30 years ago, there were a handful of rabbinical fanatics who had blue in their tzitzit. Now you see it everywhere, at least in Israel.
Really?
I wouldn't say most people have it. I would say it's maybe 10%, maybe 5%, but it's not a rarity. You see it every day in Orthodox Jews wearing tzitzit. So it's not so unusual these days. One of the things about the tzitzit is that Newman, back when he was living in Israel as a film student at Hebrew University, the guy is so creative, but he's more of an absent-minded professor than I am. I mean, he has a very poor sense of direction. Well, he's walking home at midnight on a Saturday night. We were actually watching the movie Casablanca at a friend's house.
Okay.
And on the way back to his dorm, he takes a wrong turn, ends up walking through a forest. It's ironically called the Peace Forest. It's on the outskirts of Jerusalem near Bethlehem. And as he's walking through the forest in the middle of the night, he turns a corner and there are three Arabs standing in front of him. Well, they look at him. He's not wearing a kippah. So at first they think, well, maybe he's not Jewish. But then they see the tzitzit, and he's got the blue in them. He's a Karaite like I am. And so they see Newman's tzitzit, and they say, okay, that's a Jew. We need to kill him.
Mm-hmm.
One of them pulls out a knife. The other two grab him and hold him down, and they start slashing him. And they actually slash him twice. And if you see Newman, the first thing you notice on his cheek and on his neck are these huge gashes to this day. Well, they slash him twice, and the Arab man raises the knife to do a third slash, and Newman thinks, okay, this is the last moment of my life. I'm going to die. And you know, he wasn't so far off. That third slash would have been the end of his life. He screams out the name Yehovah. He's calling out to his God as he thinks he's about to die. And the next thing he knows, he's running through the forest. He doesn't know how he got out of them. Each one was holding him, an arm holding him down, and he's running through the forest. And he lived. And I mean, he's like gushing blood. There's like arterial spray. I mean, this is you know, something like from the movies where, like, every time the heart pumps, it's gushing out blood through his neck. He actually took his shirt off. It's spraying out. He took his shirt off and wrapped it around his neck and you know, put pressure on it. And if he hadn't done that, he probably wouldn't have lived. And they told him that if it had been a millimeter closer, he would not have lived, a fraction of a millimeter. So he eventually gets to the emergency room and he survived. But it was only through this miracle where he called out Yehovah's name, and all of a sudden he's free. And I mean, wow, there's something symbolic about that. And so we thought, who better to make this movie? Because one of the power or this video for the Blessed is the Man, because one of the powerful things is that Andrew read Keith's book. If you look in the introduction, he's actually listed there as one of the study partners, and it has a reaction there that he gives. He read Keith's book and he incorporated the information. And the song Blessed is the Man isn't about the name of the Father. It's not about that at all. It's about it's just Psalm 1.
Mm-hmm.
But he has incorporated that information and is now walking it out and using it. Because that's what it says in the psalm. It says the name Yehovah there.
Yeah.
So he's actually now using it and implementing it. So he thought, who better to do the video than the person whose life was saved by calling out that name? And so Newman, because the tzitzit had such an important part in his life, that essentially it was one of the reasons he got attacked, he decided, okay, he's going to make that the central theme of the video. And in the video, there is a non-Jewish man who grabs onto the tzitzit of a Jewish man, and that's actually a reference to the prophecy in Zechariah 8:23, that 10 men of all the languages of the earth shall grab hold of the knaf, the corner of the garment, that's where the tzitzit goes, of the Jew, and say, we've heard God is with you. And it's interesting, they don't say, okay, you're our covering, now tell us what to do. They said, we heard God's with you, teach us so that we can do it ourselves and know ourselves. And that's the message of the video, that blessed is the man, not just the man who, and of the psalm, I think, not just the Jew and for the Gentile to look on and not be part of it, but this is a message for all mankind to embrace God's word.
Amen, amen. And of course, the tzitzit, they are very prominent in the video clip. That really comes across, and the video clip is excellent. And as I said before, I was touched by it, really blessed by it. I watched it a couple of times, and I really encourage the listeners to go look it up on YouTube and watch it for yourself, and you will be blessed.
And actually, the best place to find the video is on Keith's website, hishallowedname.com. You know, he's got the new book, His Hallowed Name Revealed Again. Mm-hmm. So he has it up there on the website, hishallowedname.com. That way you'll get the original undubbed version on hishallowedname.com.
Thank you very much. Now, you mentioned, Nehemia, you mentioned for all mankind. And I want to pick up
Absolutely.
On that because that's going to be just something that I want to talk about now, the focus of our conversation. Of course, it says in Exodus chapter 12 that there is one Torah for Israel, the native born, and for the foreigner that dwells with him.
Amen.
Amen.
Absolutely.
And this is what I'd like to explore with you. Before I do that, though, can I just, I'd like to quote you from a couple of weeks ago. You wrote, so this is something that you wrote on your Facebook wall. You wrote, mm-hmm. And this was in regards, I believe, to a Thanksgiving address that you gave. And you wrote, my Facebook wall has become a battleground mm-hmm. over the validity of Thanksgiving. Some people are convicted it is a wonderful Puritan expression of Sukkot. Others say it is an evil holiday born in the demonic realm alongside Halloween and Christmas. I have to admit, I never had that much of an issue with Halloween or Christmas. You're laughing already. I did not grow up celebrating these holidays. To me, they were kind of exotic alien festivals like Kwanzaa or that Aztec festival with all the skulls. Christmas was a little annoying with all the season's greetings, but it was never something I had an emotional connection to. Now, I thought that when I read that, that was hilarious, and I read that a number of times, because to compare something like Christmas to the Aztec festival with all the skulls, end quote, it really got me thinking. And I thought, I think it's been about 6 years since I and my family have not observed Christmas, you know, the Constantinian celebration, the holy day of Christmas, according to the Constantinian religion. And and I, of course, we have an emotional connection to it in that, first of all, you go through this sort of feeling of, you know, I'm a little bit awkward about not doing it because my family's doing it, all my, you know, Christian friends are doing it. Then you kind of grow out of that and go through a feeling of, I've been deceived all these years, and I'm really cranky about it, and I just want to tell other people that this is just part of the deception, and go on with that for a little while. And I've noticed, and I'm really pleased about this, I'm coming out of that phase now, and I realize I'm coming into a phase where I look at it, and I look at all the decorations and all the lights and everything that goes around in suburbia and so on and so forth, and I'm kind of looking at it as something a little bit strange, something a little bit alien. I'd like to think that perhaps in a year or two I'll be looking at in the same sort of light as that Aztec festival with all the skulls.
I think that's called the Day of the Dead, if I'm not mistaken.
I think you are correct.
It's a major festival in Mexico, and you know, yeah, I mean, it really is quite similar if you think about it. I mean, certainly from my perspective, it's interesting. I was once having a conversation with a Jewish friend who had brought his best friend who was a Jesuit priest to come and hear this presentation that I was doing. And before I went on, he heard another speaker who was talking about Christmas, because I don't talk about Christmas. It's really got nothing to do with me. But this other speaker was talking about it and saying how originally it was the birthday of Mithras. So this Jewish friend of mine, who he doesn't know anything about Christmas, he asked the Jesuit, because this is the answer man. This guy is, you know, Jesuits especially are extremely educated. Sure. So he asked the Jesuit, is it true that Christmas was originally a pagan holiday, the birthday of Mithra? And the Jesuit, without skipping a beat, says, yeah, of course it's true. That the church does is it appropriates the ways of the pagans and Christianizes them and makes it a victory for Christianity. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an incredible explanation. In other words, the facts of the history of Christmas, you can find it in the Catholic Encyclopedia.
That's right.
They're not in dispute. They're not in dispute. That's what I find so interesting about it. You know, Hanukkah, I know a lot of people have this discussion. Is it pagan or is it not pagan? I'm not convinced. I don't see the evidence there. I see that there's some similarities to a certain fire festival, but it's disputable. Christmas, there's really no dispute.
No.
I mean, if you ask historians or even the Jesuit priests or the Catholic Church, they believe that this was originally the birthday of Mithra, and they wanted to basically win over Constantine's army. Constantine wanted to win over his army, which was largely made up of Mithraists. So he compromised with them. He said, okay, you can keep worshiping Mithra, but just call him Jesus and we'll worship him on Sunday instead of Shabbat. Mm-hmm. And we'll even worship on his birthday. And everybody was happy, so to speak, in air quotes, everyone was happy because the Christians had Jesus and the Mithraists had their Sunday and their Christmas.
And everybody and, was coming together.
It's right. And to this day, you see very similar things happening. I saw a documentary just the other day about the patron goddess of, I think it was Venezuela, which is some Inca goddess who they continue to worship, except now she was raised as a child by the Virgin Mary, and I forget what her name is, Maria Luisa or something like that. And everyone knows that she was originally an Inca goddess, but now she's a Catholic saint.
Wow! Good heavens! And of course, these things are no great secret. I mean, they're just, it's documented history. You can go back and find it out. You only have to get on the internet and look up a couple of things. But what really bothered me, of course, Nehemiah, was the realization that what is documented history, what is known fact, and particularly by people who are, go to the seminaries, they go to the Bible colleges and so on and so forth, like I did. I know for a fact that these people have the information, they just choose not to tell their flock, so to speak. And when I found that out, I was a little bit cranky, as, one would expect to be. And I guess for me, one of the first things that came to light in my life was Shabbat about 5 years ago, and the realization that the fourth commandment is the fourth commandment and I should be keeping the commandments. And Shabbat was the very first thing. It wasn't long after that that my wife and I began to look at the Leviticus 23, and that kind of made sense, and we started to kind of implement memorializing these days, and it was sometime later, in fact, Nehemiah, it was a couple of years later, I hate to say, that we investigated the Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14, the dietary laws and so on and so forth. And I have to admit, at the time, it seemed a little bit strange to me. And I look back and I almost feel nauseous at what I used to eat. But we implemented that. Now, it says in Hosea chapter 8, verses 11 to 12, it says, because Ephraim has made many altars for sin, they have become for him altars for sinning. But I have written for him the great things of my law, but they were considered a strange thing. Now, I have to say, as we progressed into Torah and progressed into implementing it in our lives, at first they seemed like strange things. And I'm pleased to say that now that I look back, and particularly after reflecting on your comment a couple of weeks ago, I'm now starting to look at things like Christmas and looking at those as strange things. And I just find that interesting. Now, there are still things, of course, in the Torah that I find difficult. And the reason, obviously, is culturally, we just have a hard time wrapping our brain around it. When you come from out of the Constantinian religion, as you can appreciate, when you spend all your life absent from these things, sometimes we come to certain passages in the scripture, in the Torah, and we have a hard time figuring out how it is we're meant to work this out in our life. Well, one of those things that we've been dwelling on in the last, I'd say a couple of weeks, if not more, is, of course, the Torah regarding Nida. And we're talking about, of course, Leviticus chapter 15. Can we chat about that for a little while?
Yeah, before we get to that, let me make two comments. One is, you mentioned about how the people at the seminaries know about Christmas. Mm-hmm. And this is a story that a man told me in Kentucky. He was telling me about how for years he's been telling his son-in-law that Christmas has this pagan origin, it's related to Mithra, And the son-in-law would blow him off and say, oh, you conspiracy theorist, that's so silly. I mean, how can that be? You know, we wouldn't be celebrating in the church if that was true. Well, now the son-in-law has gone to seminary, a well-known seminary in the South. In the south of the U.S., which is, you know, the they call that the Bible Belt.
Sure.
And he calls up his father-in-law and he says, they taught us in seminary that what you said is true, but that Christmas has this pagan origin. Mm-hmm. But then they told us, don't tell your congregation, don't mm-hmm. tell your flock, because if you do, you'll lose them. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't affect their salvation anyway, so they just don't need to know this. Mm-hmm. And I thought, are you kidding me? You know, I read it in Ezekiel 34, and it talks about the evil shepherds that instead of grazing the sheep, they're grazing on the sheep. That's what it says in Hebrew. It's a play on words.
They're trampling down instead the grass, you know, taking, and muddying the waters, and they're grazing.
Well,
the sheep.
But instead of taking the sheep out into the pasture so they can eat the good food, they're turning the sheep into food themselves. Mm-hmm. And I mean that's what I heard from that. I mean that's the role of the shepherds to protect the flock, not to hide information from them. That's how I look at it.
Look,
and then you talked about the
before we go on, let me throw this into the mix, Nehemiah. I was there was a church not far from where I do the radio program in here in Young, and they decided to have an afternoon service, if you like, and sort of a relaxed afternoon service, and it suited me time wise. And they said in their flyer, be prepared to ask questions. Feel free to come in and ask questions. And I thought, oh, this is the kind of thing I like doing. I love to discuss. I love to ask questions. I reckon I could have some fun here. So I turned up to this afternoon casual service, and it so happened that they were working their way through the book of Mark. And of course, they got to Mark chapter 7. And they were talking about the washing of the hands. Now, this is something that, of course, appears, okay. Yes, it appears in some detail in your first book, which is the Hebrew Yeshua versus the Greek Jesus. Now, mm-hmm. when it came to talking about the washing of the hands and so on and so forth, I put up my hand and I said, now, where does it talk about the washing of the hands in the Bible? Where is it commanded? And the pastor said, I don't know. I guess you know. And I said, well, I'd be happy to tell you if you like. So I explained it to them, and oh my goodness, I have never been so opposed so quickly. They rang me
really
during the week, and they said, please don't come back. And I said, why don't you want me to come back?
Wow.
And they said, well, because you believe in a works-based salvation. And I said, really? But where do you get a workspace salvation from? We're not saved by the measure of our righteousness, as you and I were talking about in Ezekiel 18 and 33. I said, when have I ever said that we are saved by our righteousness? And they said, well, no, that's what you believe, and we don't want you to come back. I said, it's not what I believe. Wow. And besides that, I said, I can tell you, I know Catholics believe in a work-based salvation. However, in your flyer, you said that Catholics were welcome. How is it that I am not welcome? Any case, they put their foot down. They said, you're not coming back. And so I wasn't allowed to come back after I explained to them
wow.
what the washing of the hands were, what the rabbinic laws were in this regard, what it was that Yeshua was saying, and, of course, Leviticus 11 and Deuteronomy 14. The problem is, of course, they all had dinner after this casual afternoon church, and it was all sprinkled with bacon. So we can't have that. And if you explain these, as you say, Nehemiah, if you explain these things to the people go away, the establishment falls apart, and there is no superannuation. There's no retirement fund.
Yeah, I see. Yeah, you know, I mean, going back to the issue of Christmas, in a way I have more respect for the Catholic, that Jesuit who said we've Christianized and appropriated the ways of the pagans, because at least he's being honest. You know, if somebody wants to keep Christmas after they understand what it is, it's not my place. Maybe it's your place, but it's not my place to tell them they shouldn't do that.
Sure.
That's like telling the Aztec he shouldn't keep the Day of the Dead. Mm. But it's obvious to the Aztec what that is. You know, I think if somebody wants to keep Christmas, they think, well, it's a nice custom. You know, that's between them and God. But I think they should at least know what the truth is. That's my position on that. You know, I'm not against Christmas, and I understand you coming from there. You have to be. But to me, you know, like I said, this is some foreign thing. It's like me telling African Americans not to keep Kwanzaa. You know, I don't know what the origin of Kwanzaa is, but if it turned out to be pagan, I would want them to know that. And if they want to still keep it, you know, knock yourself out. That's between you and God. That's how I look at that. Well, you talked about the – well, go ahead, sir.
I was just going to say off the top of my head, and I think I'm paraphrasing Deuteronomy chapter 12 near the end of the chapter, but doesn't Yehovah say, when you come into the land, you're coming in, do not observe the ways of the pagans. Do not worship me in those ways. Is that mm-hmm. fair?
Yeah, absolutely. He definitely says that. Mm. But there's no question that paganism is forbidden in the Torah, but if people choose to be, you know, to observe pagan things, that's their decision. Now, you mentioned about eating. And you know what? I literally don't understand that. Maybe you can explain to me what the Christian understanding of this is. Sure. But in Deuteronomy 14:3, in my Bible, it says, "Do not eat any abomination." Mm. Here in the King James, "Thou shalt not eat any abominable thing." In Hebrew, it says, "Do not eat any abomination." Yep. Now, I know that the Christian world gets all worked up about a certain other abomination, that they don't want to have anything to do that, that that's evil, and they're ready to bash people who are involved in that other abomination. Sure. Now, it's a genuine question. I don't understand how, when it comes to this abomination, because what comes afterwards is here's what you should eat and here's what you should not eat. Sure. Here's what's an abomination, or here's not what's not an abomination, here's what is. Mm. I honestly don't understand how they disregard that.
It is mind-blowing, Nehemiah. It is absolutely mind-blowing. Yeah. In fact, I was having a conversation with a Muslim, and they said to me, how is it that they eat swine? How is it that Christians feel they can eat swine? And I recently explained to them what it is. And I mean, the funny thing, well, it's not funny, but I think it is Peter writes, he reiterates Leviticus, be holy, for Yehovah is holy, so be holy. Mm-hmm. And, of course, this is in the context of the dietary laws. Now, they love to quote that, but they won't tell you where it's from. They won't go and investigate how we are to be set apart. And the reason is, Nehemiah, is that they take mostly the writings of Paul, and they twist them around. There's also...
And I'm familiar with the various justifications. I still don't get it.
Well, they read it, and they say... they read certain little parts of it, and they say, see, all food is clean. And they define food according to their own definition rather than looking to see how Yehovah has defined food. They look at Acts chapter 10, and they interpret that to say that, you see, now we can eat all food is clean now. Because, you know, God lowered a sheet of all animals in front of Peter and told him to eat them all. And of course, that's not what happened either. But it's a matter of interpretation, unfortunately. And it's a matter of interpreting external from its context and detached from the Torah. I take Christians back to, Isaiah chapter 66 verse 17. And it's talking about what is commonly referred to as the day of the Lord. Okay. And what it says is, it talks about those who eat swine, the abomination, and the mouse, that they shall be consumed together. And I say, now this is in future context. It's future context. How do you understand this? If everything that you think is food now is okay to shove into your mouth and to consume, just because you consume it doesn't make it food, but if you think that it's food and it's okay now, how do you explain this verse? And none of them have been able to do it. But you know what? They most for the most part, they will leave my presence, go home and make a ham sandwich and then eat it and go to bed. It blows my mind.
Uh-huh.
It absolutely blows my mind. Anyhow, but you know what? Now, coming full circle, Nehemiah, the reason is because they regard his Torah, they regard his many laws to be a strange thing.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's it. I guess that's the bottom line. Well, okay, you asked about Leviticus 15, the laws of Nidah, of what usually is translated as, actually often refer to this as family purity laws. I don't like that phrase. It's the impurity that's associated with a woman's menstruation.
Sure.
And it's actually a pretty important thing. If you look at Ezekiel chapter 18, verses 5 through 9, verse 9, it says here, it's talking about a certain person who's righteous, and it says the basic things that he does. It says, he walks in my statutes and keeps my judgments to do truth. This is a righteous man. He shall surely live, says Lord Jehovah. Mm-hmm. And then what's defined in the previous verses, in the preceding verses, is it says, verse 5, and a man is righteous and is righteous, justice and righteousness. He does not eat towards the mountains, and that has to do with idolatry. He does not raise his eyes to the idols of the house of Israel. He does not defile his his neighbor's wife, meaning he doesn't commit adultery. And it says he does not approach a woman in Nidah. So this is one of the biggies. This is one of the big commandments that separates the righteous from the unrighteous. And it says a person who does these things shall live. So what is Nidah? And what that's referring to in not approaching a woman, that's actually in Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20. And it says in verse Leviticus 18, 19, and to a woman in her impurity of nidah, you must not approach to uncover her nakedness. And then Leviticus 20, 18, it says a man who has, and it literally says a man who lays with a woman who is menstruating and has uncovered her nakedness, he has uncovered her source and she has uncovered the source of her blood. Both of them shall be cut off from their people. So this is a pretty big deal. Now in Leviticus 15, it has a whole series of laws about becoming ritually unclean from the woman in that state of nidah. What it doesn't say is it's forbidden to become ritually unclean from her. And what I mean by that is it talks about, for example, if she sits on a chair and then you sit on the chair, then you become unclean until, you know, you wash in water and become unclean until evening. And some people, I've seen a lot of people who are relatively new to the Torah who look at this and they kind of misunderstand it. And hello?
Yeah, I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, the connection is so clear, I thought we got disconnected. So I've seen people who are relatively new in walking the Torah, and they look at this passage in Leviticus 15, and they think, oh, I've got to get my wife a separate chair. And actually, some Orthodox Jews do that. In Orthodox Judaism, during that period of the Nidah, the ritual impurity from menstruation, the woman actually sleeps in a separate bed, based on this passage in Leviticus 15.
Right.
And that's actually, if you go to a five-star hotel in Israel, it'll always have, usually have, a single bed that you can separate. And they call that a bed with a Jewish arrangement, they call that, based on the Orthodox interpretation of this passage. And I think that's a misunderstanding. I think the key verse in Leviticus 15 is verse 31, which explains what all those commandments are about. Now, in Leviticus 18, 20, you have that specific commandment not to have sex with a woman when she is in that state of nidah, and we'll define what that is in a minute. But here in verse 31 of Leviticus 15, it says, and you shall separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness so that they not die in their uncleanness when they make the place where I dwell in their midst unclean. And what it's saying here is, and when it says where I dwell, that's the word in Hebrew, mishkan. So you could also translate it when they make unclean my mishkan, my tabernacle, which is in their midst. So the whole point of this set of commandments in Leviticus 15 is to keep you from desecrating the tabernacle, from going into the tabernacle after you sat in the same chair as your wife or touched your wife while she was in a state of ritual impurity or somehow contracted ritual impurity. When you're in that state, you must not go into the tabernacle. What's interesting is the very next chapter, Leviticus 16, is the laws of Yom Kippur, of the sacrifices on the Day of Atonement, which is the holiest day of the biblical year. And one of the central sacrifices is to atone for the desecration of the tabernacle that the Israelites have done. Meaning, there's a recognition that although we have all these rules and regulations not to enter the tabernacle in a state of ritual impurity, realistically, that's occasionally going to happen. A person will not realize that he sat in the chair with a woman who menstruated sat, or he touched a woman who was menstruating, or whatever. And so one of the main sacrifices on Yom Kippur is to atone for the sins of the Israelites for violating, for essentially making unclean the tabernacle of God. So this is this is actually a big deal. The purpose of all these commandments is to keep you from entering the tabernacle while you're in that state of ritual impurity. Now, having said that, there are actually two, or I should say three types of nidah, and this is something that a lot of people also misunderstand. Three types of menstrual impurity, or ways of three different categories, I should say, of menstrual impurity. The first one is the regular nidah, and what that describes in Leviticus 15 is from when a woman first sees blood, then for 7 days she's ritually unclean. So, in other words, the entire period is 7 days. The entire span of the nidah is 7 days. And during those 7 days, according to Leviticus 18 and Leviticus 20, when she's in that state of ritual impurity, he can't have sex with her. That's the regular period. Then it talks about two different scenarios of an irregular period. The first scenario is that a woman, it says, bleeds for many days, not in her regular time. In other words, she has a regular period every month, but all of a sudden she bleeds for 3 or 4 days. That's not part of her regular time. And modern scientists would tell us that that's either a disease, or more often it's actually a miscarriage. The Torah doesn't specify. Whatever the cause is, she bleeds for multiple days. That's not part of her regular period. So in that case, she doesn't count 7 days like she does from when she first sees blood with the regular period. She counts 7 bloodless days. In other words, let's say she bleeds for 4 days, not as part of her regular time. Then after she, the first day that she no longer sees blood, that's day one, and she counts for 7 days from there. And at the end of those 7 days, then she's considered ritually clean, and she can be with her husband. Then they can have sex. The third scenario, or the second scenario of the irregular period, is a woman who bleeds beyond the 7 days, meaning she has a normal period, and let's say her normal period is normally on average about 5 days. Sure. Some women it's a little bit longer. Let's say she bleeds into the eighth day. So if she bleeds into the eighth day, and it could be 9 or 10 or 100, but as long as she bleeds beyond 7 days, then she has to also count 7 bloodless days, 7 days without blood.
Okay, so let me get this straight in my mind if I can. 7 bloodless sure. days, we're counting 7 more days after that particular blow ceases. Is that correct?
That is correct, meaning okay. 7 days where there's no blood.
Right.
So all the days with blood, her husband can't have sex with her, and also the 7 days afterwards. Now that's that type of irregular period, of which there's two categories, that's usually referred to as zava. Zava means the flow, and that's a word that's actually used in Leviticus 15. So we have nida, and there's another two subcategories, special types of nida that are called zava. So the zava type one, which is she bleeds for multiple days, probably 3 or more. And then the other zava type two is where she bleeds into the eighth day and beyond. And in both zava one and zava two, she needs 7 bloodless days. Now here's where the confusion enters. A lot of people, and I think especially people in your community, if I can call it that, who are not coming from a Jewish background, who look and see what did the Jews do, what they see is that what the Orthodox Jews do is they treat every single period as zava, as an irregular period.
Yeah, right. Now, so it goes every on for single 14 days is my understanding. There is
right.
a period
well,
of 14 days.
Not necessarily 14 days. It's whatever the number of days of her period, mm-hmm. plus 7 bloodless days.
Right.
That is right. In other words, if she bleeds normally for 2 days or for 6 days, which whatever it is, mm-hmm. Then it's those days that he can't be with her plus 7 bloodless days.
Right.
Now in Leviticus 15, that only applies to the zava. But in Orthodox Judaism, what they've done, and you know, I talk about in my first book, the Takanot. This is a clear example of Takanot. It's even called that in the rabbinical literature. It's a Takana, a rabbinical enactment, a law that essentially takes every type of period and every type of nida, and it turns it into zava. And the reason they did that is they said, we want to be careful. We're not sure what the different types of blood are. And therefore, we're going to treat all blood as zava. Now, that and it's actually an entire tractate in the Talmud that called Nida that deals with this, that deals with the different types of blood. And I'll tell a little embarrassing story. I don't know if I've ever shared this in public before, but I'll go ahead anyway. Do we have time?
Oh, absolutely.
How are we doing at time? Okay, so. The way I learned about the birds and the bees is I was a little, I think I was probably like 8 years old, and I was studying the Talmud with my father, and we got to this discussion about the different types of blood. And I said, Dad, I don't understand what this is talking about. And he explained to me about the birds and the bees. And I said, that can't be true. I have 4 sisters. I live in a house with 5 women, and I've never heard of this. It can't be true. He said, we can go ask your sister Ariella if you don't believe me. And I'm like, no. So maybe that explains some of my attitude towards the Talmud, or at least in my early years. It was a little traumatic. But really, this is something the rabbis go into great detail about. And the reason they go into such detail about it, you know, the Torah talks about the Zava type one. Mm-hmm. It says she bleeds for many days, Yamim Rabim, which is many days. The rabbis kind of ignore that. And what they say is, and I'll quote you from the Talmud, it says, and actually it blames the Israelite women. It says, the daughters of Israel have imposed upon themselves the restriction that even if they observe it, this is a quote from the Talmud, the daughters of Israel have imposed upon themselves the restriction that even if they observe a drop of blood the size of a mustard seed, they wait on account of it 7 clean days, meaning 7 bloodless days. Now, what that means is it's not a flow like described in the Torah, according to Orthodox Judaism. It's not just a flow of blood as described in the Torah. It means that if a woman sees even the smallest drop of blood, then she considers herself either nida or zavat, doesn't matter, because then you count 7 bloodless days in the rabbinical system. Well, this becomes a big problem because, I mean, to be blunt, well, you're a married man, you know, a woman has various types types of discharges.
Sure.
Well, if there's any kind of discharge, many Orthodox women will go into a panic, and they have to decide, is this a discharge that's considered blood or not considered blood? And you know what? It's not always so clear. Mm. So there are actually certain rabbis who are experts that in looking at these discharges. I'm not making this up. There are rabbis who women, Orthodox, very devout Orthodox women, will bring them pap smears regularly, sometimes daily, and say, Rabbi, look at this pap smear and tell me, is this blood that I have to wait 7 days or can I have sex with my husband tonight? And I remember being told stories about how miracles happened of righteous women who brought the pap smear to the rabbi and their lives were saved because of it. I mean, this is considered a wonderful thing. This is not something that's hidden or they're embarrassed of. It's considered there are miracles associated with this, how women's lives were saved because the rabbi looked at it and said, you have cancer, which actually might be true. But I don't see anywhere in the Torah where it says you have to bring a pap smear to the rabbi. And it doesn't say that that if you see a drop of blood the size of a mustard seed. It talks about a flow of blood, and I think a flow of blood should be obvious what that is. Anyway, the one of the commentaries in the Talmud explains that what the rabbis did is they took this self-imposition of the women of Israel, this rule that supposedly some Israelite peasant women decided for themselves, and they made it a takana. That's actually what it says in the Me'iri, which is commentary on the Babylonian Talmud. Okay. So this takana, they attribute it to a rabbi named Rabbi Zera, who lived probably sometime in the second or third century. So this is a clear case of a takana, and it's actually a relatively late takana, second or third century, where the rabbis have taken the initial commandment in the Torah, which distinguishes between three types of a period, the regular period, and the two irregular periods, many days of blood or beyond the 7 days into the eighth day, and they've made all of them into the irregular period. That's the takana of the rabbis, and it has profound effect on people's lives. Remember, I mentioned that in many Orthodox Jews, most Orthodox Jews will sleep in a separate bed from their wife during the period of Nida. Sure. Well, that can be a two-week period. That normally is a two-week period. That means half their married lives, they're sleeping in separate beds.
Isn't that amazing?
I mean, that has a profound impact. There are actually women, it's a known thing in the Orthodox world, there are women who can't conceive because of this takana of the rabbis, because their most fertile time is just after their a number of days after their period.
Right.
And it's within that seven-day span.
That they ovulate.
For some women. Right, mm-hmm. That's when they ovulate. And so there are women who can't conceive because of this, and they're considered saints. They're considered women who have sacrificed their womanhood, their ability to have children, for the glory of the oral law, essentially, for the glory of the authority of the rabbis. I don't see that in the Torah. I mean, and it's really interesting because you talked about how your attitude towards Christmas, how that's you have this emotional attachment to it, and in a way, that's how I look at the oral law. That I went through this phase where how can I not observe these things? This is what my ancestors did. Some of my ancestors were great rabbis. And I guess your attitude towards Christmas is the attitude I had towards the things I'm describing now. And now I'm beginning to look at these things after many years of studying the Torah and realizing this isn't commanded anywhere, and not just realizing that intellectually, but emotionally saying, this is a strange thing, like the festival of the skulls in Mexico.
Right.
But it took me a long time to get to that. It took me a while to get to that place.
And I can appreciate that. Can I ask you then, and I really thank you so much for explaining that, because really the rabbis have once again muddied the waters, and this is just no exception. And the many conversations that I've had with people and that my wife have had with other women, whether they realize it or not, the rabbinic teachings do come through in their understanding, and for some reason it seems to be a bit of a hurdle. So I really do appreciate you explaining that. Now, my next question.
What's interesting before you ask that is that if you look at the rabbinical commentators, even Rashi, who is generally upholds the rabbinical interpretation, mm-hmm. he explains that the plain meaning of the passage is what I just explained. Like, for example, when it says beyond her regular nidah in Leviticus 15:25, mm-hmm. it explains, he says, beyond the days of her nidah by one day, this is avah, and its law is given in this passage. And its law is not like the law of nidah, since it requires, I'm quoting from Rashi, since it requires counting 7 clean days, etc. So he says, but the 7 days she shall be in the state of nida, whether she etc. So in any event, so they on the one hand interpret the passage correctly, but when it comes to implementing it, then the takanot kick in, and the takanot say, well, we don't care what the passage says. Mm-hmm. Here's how we're going to implement it. And the way we implement it is, in my view, in addition to the Torah, and makes it a heavy burden upon the people when it's not supposed to be.
When it's not supposed to be, absolutely. Now, you mentioned that there is, say, for example, hotels that have beds that can detach for that reason.
Oh, that's standard in Israel, yeah.
The standard in Israel. How, even for one of the nations, here I am, having come out of the Constantinian religion, how are we to somehow observe this? I mean, I understand that you mentioned verse 31 that says that specifically, it says, thus you shall separate the children of Israel from their uncleanness, lest they die in their uncleanness when they defile my temple, tabernacle, that is among them. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're not going to the tabernacle these days. How much of this are we to be implementing? How should we implement this in our lives?
Well, I would say all of it is applicable. But the application is only in two things. One is in the context of the tabernacle, and two, the second, and the, I think the more relevant for most people today is having sex with your wife. Right. Meaning, what Ezekiel is talking about and what Leviticus 18:20 are talking about is during that period of ritual uncleanness, you are not to have sex with your wife, not to come close to uncover her nakedness, is the term it uses in the, or to lay with her in Leviticus 20. So I think that's the more practical application for most people today. And even in ancient times, if you were an Israelite farmer 3,000 years ago in the Galilee harvesting your crops, it made no lick of a difference whether you slept in the same bed as your wife and sat in the same chair as your wife. When you came up to the tabernacle or the temple, as you were about to go in, you would go through a ritual process of purification, of washing in water and waiting till evening. And what's interesting is in the New Testament, it actually talks about Paul doing this, how Paul had been traveling amongst the Gentiles, and he was undoubtedly ritually unclean, and so he goes through a 7-day process of purification. Mm-hmm. Why 7 days? Because there he's being not impurified from Nidah, but he's being impurified from touching a dead body or even touching a grave, or even being in the same room as a dead body. So when he was coming up to the temple, that was the time when this would kick in, and we say, okay, now we have to go and purify ourselves. But if you're out in traveling amongst the nations or even in the land of Israel and not dealing with the tabernacle or with the sacrifices, then really it doesn't have a day-to-day application other than having sex with your wife.
Okay.
Which is kind of a big deal too, you know, but it doesn't mean go and buy a separate chair for your wife or something like that. The Torah says nothing, you know, that's not what the Torah is saying. Here's the bottom line. It's not a sin. You don't die from becoming ritually unclean. Right. What you die from spiritually is if you're ritually unclean and then enter into the holy place of God.
Right.
That's the key.
That is the key. Okay, so we shouldn't necessarily be making arrangements for my wife to be sleeping in a separate bed during her time of customary impurity?
I don't see that commanded in the Torah anywhere.
Right. So now, but if I was to, if there was a tabernacle, however, and I was...
If there's a tabernacle and you're coming up to the tabernacle, then the day before you go in, you need to and generally, why is there a commandment that the males come up on the three feasts, on the three pilgrimages? Mm-hmm. It doesn't say the females, and it's not because the Torah is trying to be sexist. It's because 25% of the year they're ritually unclean, and it would be a undue burden on those women to make them come up for the three pilgrimage feasts, whereas the men don't have that issue. And so the point is, when you're coming up to the pilgrimage feast, you're probably not going to be with your wife either. And if she does come up, then you just need to be careful if she's in that state of ritual impurity, that before you go into the temple, you wash yourself in water, wait until sunset, and then you go in. And actually, in archaeological excavations from the first century, all the area around the temple, leading up to the temple, it's surrounded by these mikvahs, by these baths, essentially a bath where you would immerse yourself in water. You know, they didn't have running water, so they would catch every drop of water they could from rainwater, pool it into this bath, this pool essentially, or a bath, a cold bath that was lined with plaster to keep the water from seeping out. And just before you walked into the temple, you would immerse yourself in the water. You'd, you know, that's where the Christians get the baptism. You'd immerse yourself in water, and then you would come out the come out and you would be clean as soon as the sun would set. And then you would go into the temple. And the reason it's at the entrance of the temple is because realistically on the way to the temple, there's all kinds of impurities that you're going to come upon. And so the practical place to have them is at the entrance of the temple.
Right.
But if you're not going into the temple, it doesn't really have much application.
Right. Brilliant. That is great. Thank you so much for clarifying that. I'm really hoping that those listening can now go back to Leviticus 15 and just make a little more sense of it.
Mm-hmm.
Marvelous.
Yep. Yeah, and it's, you know, I mean, part of the problem here, I think, is that, you know, through these takanot, we've even I coming, you know, from the Orthodox, and maybe especially me coming from the Orthodox background, I mean, again, this is my Christmas. For me, this was something I was deeply emotionally attached to. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the question would, when I first had to deal with these issues, it was like, well, wait a minute, you know, am I allowed to do this? But everybody else does this. And it was actually reading the rabbinical commentaries and think, you know, because I read this myself and I thought, but can that really be right? And I read the rabbinical commentaries and they have the same exact interpretation. They just don't follow it because of the takanot. And that's what convinced me, seeing that the rabbis understand this correctly, yet they say do something else. And it's almost like they're saying, don't do as we interpret, do as we tell you to do. So, you know, and I think it's once you understand that, you could peel away those layers of tradition, you can get to the truth.
Sure, sure. And once again, I suppose it's another example of when Yeshua said, when they sit in Moses' seat, do what he tells mm-hmm. them to do, what he tells you to do, but do not do what they do.
Right. Mm. There you go. I think it's exactly an example of that. Yep. They claim to have that Mosaic authority. Yep.
Nehemiah Gordon, thank you so much for coming back on the Truth to You and sharing with us your wisdom from the Torah, Yah's wisdom from the Torah, and just making it a little clearer to us. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for having me. Shalom.
Shalom.